Israel is so much a part of being Jewish, cannot separate Israel from Judaism or Jews. It's just not in the cards. I mean, there's no option to lose.
The flag was hoisted before the world.
What does it mean to fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
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 With Shai Davidai.
Showing up at a protest is always a bit scary. You hear about a protest, you decide to show up, you don't know how many people will be there, you don't know what kind of atmosphere it will be, and you don't know if you might end up being by yourself all alone. Yet, when you keep showing up for a protest every week, every other week, you start seeing the regulars. Right, you start seeing the civil rights leaders, the business owners, the Jewish cat ladies, and it gives me personally so much strength to keep seeing the same people and remembering that I am not alone in this fight, that all of us are motivated by something internal that brings us all out. And at some point, you start expecting to see specific people. One of those people is right here today with me. So here I am with Ari Ackerman. How are you doing, Ari?
Doing good. That's a very kind way to say hello.
Hello, yes.
Because it's my honor to be at these protests and support you and so many other people, which I'm sure we'll talk about.
Yes, the interesting thing for me is, you know, and don't take this the wrong way, I had no idea who you were. Now, obviously, you didn't know who I was because I'm a nobody, but I should have known who you were. But that's
I think we're all learning who ourselves are too. So that's
exactly.
Part of it.
I mean, in a very metaphysical way, we are, right? But I would show up at these protests and just see like people, and I don't care if people have been fighting for 50 years or just started today, if people are extremely accomplished or not, you know, it's what they do. So Ari, I'm going to start with a question. I start with everyone. What kind of a Jew are you?
That's a loaded question. But one, I'm a very, very loud and proud Jew. And when you said the intro about who I am and you see me showing up at things and, you know, and the reasons I'm there is because it's in my soul. It's in my soul to be a person who stands up and says, wait a minute, we're Jewish, we're here to stay, we're proud, we're loud, we're not going anywhere, don't mess with us. If you mess with us, we're going to show up and we're going to fight back. And that's, you know, the kind of Jew that I hope I am, that I try to be, that's been instilled in me from role models of mine that I look up to. Who I hope are very proud of the things that I'm doing today on behalf of the Jewish people.
Have you always been this way?
I can't say I've always been this way. You know, I went through a younger stage in my life where I was not as connected to my Judaism.
What were you connected to?
To going out at night and meeting lots of people and having a good time. But it was always in me. My background is I went to a yeshiva high school, Ramaz, here in New York City. And
you went to Ramaz High School.
High school.
My mother-in-law graduated Ramaz in 1972.
So she's a touch older than
me. Yes, just a little bit. Yeah.
But so it's a little known fact about me because I don't tend to be on the religious side of Judaism. I'm more of a proud, loud, secular Shabbat, you know, but that kind of a Jew. But Ramaz put in me a sense, along with family, a sense of who I am. At a very early age, and whether I knew it or not, because I don't think I knew it at the time, it said, you are a Zionist. Uh-huh. And this is why, you know, the facts are why you need to be a Zionist.
So it was almost like they didn't give you the word, the label, as if now that we're shouting for Zionists to get off trains, but it was just in the water. It's just like what you...
Well, it's like we were at a Russian, trying to get the refuseniks out, rallies, when I was... 7 years old, because Ramaz used to bus us to these rallies. Literally, I didn't know why I was there or what I was doing there. But you know later in life you were there, and you know that you were doing things that meant something. that were important at that time to fight for Jewish rights, Jewish civil rights, as I'm sure we'll talk about, in Russia or in the United States or anywhere in the world. And it just put it in you. And, you know, it's not the most important thing that is the reason I'm a loud, proud Jew, but it's something that, like, even at an early age was in me. And then I went to college, I went to Duke University, and I was like, okay, that's in me, but I'm going to go have a good time right now, and I'm going to study, and I'm going to do the things like a normal college student, and date a lot, I hope I can say this on camera, mm-hmm. date a lot of non-Jewish girls and do things that were, you know, just trying to experience life a little
bit. By the way, I should say, this is very off topic, but I personally don't care who people date and marry. As long as they live a Jewish household, like, I don't care. It's not, for me, it's not about the halacha, it's about the family.
Right. I agree. Now that I have children, though, I will say to them in the camera, you have to marry a nice Jewish boy and Jewish girl. Okay, it's the most important thing you can do. Only because...
I love your optimism that your kids will one day listen to this and not be like, my dad's an old fart, what is he doing?
They will say that, but I hope they listen also.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, it's funny you should say that, because actually, since my daughter was born, I write her these emails. She has an email address. And occasionally I write her these emails.
And she is...
She's 5 years old.
5 years old.
And for my son also, who's 2 years old. And my hope is that they someday read it. I always say they probably won't, but hopefully they will at some point, because it's expressions of love and advice and things that I feel for them at that moment in time that, you know, they'll say I'm an old fart, as you just described, but hopefully they'll also say, oh, this was maybe a piece of wisdom that dad said that maybe put something in them that I feel is important.
Have you been writing to them about the last 8 months, year?
It's,
and everything that's been happening, both in Israel, but also here?
Truth is, I haven't, because I'm very, I'm confused still about what I want to say to them. They're very young. You know, we try to shield them from everything that's going on right now, my wife and I. So it's not something that, like, I say to them in email, but it is something I'm doing actively. So I also look at my Instagram as a kind of a recorded history of things that I've been doing. And I hope Instagram doesn't go away or that there's a backup. I know there is, because this is sort of a letter. Everything I'm doing is sort of a letter to them as well, that this is the most important moment in my life thus far as a Jew, to stand up and to say, this is an existential threat to us as a people, as a livelihood, as Jews. And I want you to know, my son, my daughter, that I wasn't afraid during this time, that I stood up, that I gave speeches, that I wrote op-eds, that I posted, like you're posting, things that are get a lot of hate online. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to back down on that. I'm going to be that person that says what I think and says how I feel. And so for me, it wasn't the letter during the last, since October 7th, last 7.5-8 months, but it's been the recorded history of the actions that I've taken to show them, hopefully, that they're proud of at some point later in their life.
Yeah, I remember a story. I've been meeting a lot of very incredible and interesting people, and one of the people told me a story about a rabbi who some person comes to them for advice, and they tell the rabbi, look, rabbi, I have to tell you, like, all of my four grandparents, like, are not Jewish. You know, I converted, I'm Jewish, but, you know, I don't have the past, I don't know. But I still need your advice. And the rabbi said, I don't care about who your grandparents were. I care who your grandchildren will be. And I think that, to me, is at least for my motivation for this fight. Like, I'm fighting for Jewish civil rights so my kids won't have to.
Let me just say a big amen to that. When I tell my daughter and son I want them to marry Jewish, it's because I think it'll be easier for them in terms of their life and their whatever they're passionate about and their future. But I love people that take on Judaism, and I love people that marry somebody who's not Jewish, and they become a lot of times more Jewish than their spouse. And they fight for us, and they fight for their children. And so for me, it's just, I've seen percentages that if you intermarry, your grandchildren are less likely to be Jewish. Yeah. And that's the only reason that I stand up and say that to my children. That being said, thank you to everybody who isn't Jewish or is on our side or married Jewish and is even more on our side or feels that in their heart. Because to me, I agree with you. It's what's in your heart. It's not your birthright. It's what's in your heart. It is your birthright also, but it's more importantly what's in your heart if you feel your connection to Judaism as a human being and you pass that down from generation to generation.
And it's interesting because I feel that for someone like you, kind of like for me, it's not about the religious edict. It's not about the law. It's almost about existence, right? It's right. Like one way to fight for Jewish existence, for Jewish civil rights, is just to keep having more Jews, right? Like you can't fight for Jewish civil rights if there are no Jews. And of course, you know, some people, religious people, would say that it has to be of a, you know, of a specific, you know, Judaism and specific rules. But I feel like for me and you, it's about the Jewish heart. And you can be born with a Jewish heart, or you can create and adopt a Jewish heart.
Absolutely. Most important thing.
So, okay, so let's zoom out. You know, you've done a lot of things in your life. There's many, many things that I could focus on. The two probably most relevant things is, one, you founded a company, a venture, early on in the internet sphere,
yes.
While you were in Kellogg MBA.
Exactly.
And what I think is a very Jewish business, by the way, called Bunk One, for parents with young kids in camps, in summer camps, to get pictures and communicate with them. And I know the United States has a very illustrious history of Jews in summer camps, and I know it's, you know, there's not non-Jews also, but so you did that, and I want to hear about that. But then also at some point you became part owner of the Miami Marlins.
Correct.
Which is probably one of the most, I don't know the athletes themselves, but one of the most Jewish sport, you know, fan bases. Of course, again, not many non-Jews in Miami and many non-Jewish sport fans, but you chose baseball, the most Jewish sport, you know, and in Miami, one of the most Jewish cities. So how did you get from, you know, Ramaz to founding your company to being a part owner of the Miami Marlins to, you know, telling, you know, speaking up in a protest, saying like, hey, no, this is not okay.
Right.
That's not, what's happening there?
So that's a story of my life. So I'm happy to talk about, you know,
that's why we're here, man.
Right. So I went to Ramaz, went to Duke University undergrad. My first job out of college actually was, I worked on Capitol Hill for a congressman for a few years. I
love
politics.
You want to say who?
A guy named Gary Ackerman. Funny enough,
is that nepotism? Or?
No, I'm not. I have an uncle Gary, and he has a son Ari.
Okay.
And you're not allowed to pay relatives on Capitol Hill, so I had to sign an anti-nepotism thing that I wasn't related to him when I started getting paid. Funny enough, funny you should say that.
But we're all related.
Well, true. But we weren't like directly blood related. But we all came from Moses and stuff like that, and Abraham. So I did that for a few years. Then I went back to graduate school at Northwestern, as you described, which is a whole nother topic about disappointment in Northwestern. But I started my company there. I wrote a business plan that was originally called Acker Camps and turned into Bunk One, where I was basically changing the landscape of summer camps and bringing technology into summer camps. And you have to remember the landscape of 1999. There was no Facebook or Instagram or anything like that. And I had this idea to bring technology, specifically pictures, so parents can log in and see pictures of their kids at camp into the summer camp space.
Uh-huh.
And so I graduated from Northwestern. I wrote a business plan my last semester of school. And actually, side story, I presented it to Chicago-based venture capitalists who told me it was the worst idea they'd ever heard in their entire life. And I mean, I'll say this, I'd be doing a disservice to my school if I started this company. I'll never forget that quote from this guy.
Can I ask, was that guy Jewish?
You know, I'm not sure, but I don't think so.
Uh-huh.
I don't think so.
So
but
you didn't
I don't think
because
that mattered.
Because 1999, I was 16, and I was in a summer camp in Maine.
Which one?
It's called Meadowlark. It's a
non-Jewish
summer camp, but 75% of the kids were Jewish.
Oh, yeah.
So that was my first experience of like, oh,
were you an Israeli counselor coming?
I was first a camper, then a counselor in training, and then I came later, and that's a whole story in 2006.
Because a lot of Israelis come to these camps and be counselors and stuff like that. But I presented it. They said it was a terrible idea. But as a true entrepreneur and somebody who believes in yourself, which is an important trait of an entrepreneur, I said, no, I don't agree. And this is something I'm going to pursue. And literally the day after I graduated, I was driving around the country visiting summer camps and pitching the idea, because summer camp space, as you know from 1999, they were using the same plates they were in 1979, right, or 1959. So it's not something that was quick to adapt to change. But as you say, I was this Jewish guy driving around, and a lot of the summer camps I met early on were owned by Jews and had a lot of Jewish kids. So there was a trust factor that was involved there, because I was basically asking them to transform what they were doing at their camp in a very significant way by trusting me to say, I will post your pictures online of your kids so that life will be easier for you and parents will love it. And I know it's hard to imagine now, but that was a novel concept back then
to do that. And again, it's like, you know, not to make everything Jewish, because, you know, and I know like in the past 8 months we've had that tendency, but there's something very Jewish about A, sending your kids out to a summer camp, you know, like giving them that strength to like, to know who they are, and B, still like not letting go and being like, I want to see pictures every day and I want to hear from you. And you're my most precious thing in the world. And
exactly. And that's kind of what it solved though, too, because camps get inundated with those questions. Yeah. And so to have a way in a pastor-protected area, in a safe environment, where the parent can log in and see for themselves that little Jacob and little Rachel were doing great at camp, and then parents used to give their kids signs like, put two fingers up if you're doing okay in the picture. You know what I mean? So it became this thing that became very popular. And not to say it wasn't just Jewish kids. Like, I had YMCA camps and Girl Scout camps, and it became very popular across the United States and Canada, and something I'm very proud of. I ran that business. I can give you more detail on the business if you like. But I ran that business for about 17, 18 years until I finally sold it.
And then, how do you get into being a part owner of a baseball team?
So then I sold the business, and I got some press on the sale. Got a lot of press on the sale, and I got approached by a guy I went to Northwestern with, who's like, Ari, I saw you sold your business. I had this unique opportunity that I think you might be interested in. There's a guy putting together a group to buy a baseball team. You know, you sold. Why don't you just have a discussion with me and maybe hear about it? And the guys was Derek Jeter, if you know who Derek Jeter is. And he was putting together a group to buy a baseball team with a number of other amazing people. And, you know, you play hard to get, because this was a significant financial investment, and I'd be on the board of the team and do things with the team. And but eventually I was part of the initial group that we bought the team, and we had competition to buy the team. But it was, you know, like, wait a minute, I can go from owning a summer camp technology company and be a part owner of a baseball team?
That's like a Jewish kid's dream, right?
Jewish kid's dream, because we're more likely to own the team than play for the team, right? That's like the ultimate joke for the Jewish young athlete. And I consider myself a pretty decent athlete, but not a major league level athlete. And but it's a dream, and it's great partners in the group, and great leaders in the group, and it's just something I'm so proud to be part of.
So, and for people that are listening and not watching this online, you know, they might imagine you as like, okay, so there's this like this businessman who's also speaking, like, just to give him an example, like, you're sitting here, you got a black t-shirt, black jeans, awesome sneakers.
Miami Marlins
sneakers, you know, like if someone could meet you on the street, like, they wouldn't know. Like, there's something about you that's very, I don't know, your inside, and I mean, I guess it's also in your inside, but at least outwardly, like, very humble.
Thank you. Not
a typical person to speak up. Like, you don't see a lot of venture capitalists, successful, you know, owners, people that have started and sold companies speaking up. So why not? Why? What's unique about you? Where are all the other people?
It's a great question. I mean, because for me, I feel like it's my obligation. You know, whatever platform I have right now with the Marlins or with Bunk One or with other things that I've done in my life, family, you know, I want to use this platform to do positive things for the Jewish people, especially during its most important time of need right now. So yeah, there are other people that are speaking up. You know, there are other venture leaders and stuff like that. And those people, frankly, are my new friends and role models and idols at this point, the ones that are not being afraid to say something and being out there. And something I'm very proud of, you talked about using a platform and being proud of it is that the Miami Marlins, we were the first team, I believe in any sport, and I haven't seen anything differently, to post after October 7th. Because as soon as the atrocities took place, I got on the phone with my partners and our lead business leaders within the team, and I'm like, we need to post a support of Israel right now. And I sent them exactly what we needed to say, and we went back and forth a little bit, but we posted October 8th at about 1 o'clock on Instagram. Right. And something I'm enormously proud of,
What kind of reactions did you get?
Interesting, because even them being agreeable to post, or everybody being in agreement to post, I should say, there was a consensus pretty early on, but the wording, you know, was a little bit tricky, because when you talk about a baseball organization, you have partners, you have people who work for the organization, you have players, you have everybody who you're representing with a two-sentence Instagram post.
You have a fan base.
Families, everybody's involved in this. So, you know, there was, you know, sort of a little bit of pushback. And if you look at the comments on the post itself, it's mostly supportive. This was October 8th, don't forget, too. So there wasn't a lot of haters who were outspoken yet at that point. Yeah. But there was some, like, why are you going into this realm? Because we don't speak out on politics in the Miami Marlins office very often. So, if ever. So this was one other time, as I recall. This was a moment that I'm very proud of, to be able to use a platform to say, we support Israel, we stand behind the Jewish community. What took place was a total terrorist attack and complete atrocity.
And so, and that relates to another thing. What is Marlins Jewish Heritage Day?
So once a year, we actually have 2 days. We have Passover at the park, and we have Marlins Jewish Heritage Day.
Yeah.
Where we invite the local Jewish leaders to come be on the field and honor them. We sing HaTikvah very loudly and proudly before the game, along with the national anthem of the United States. And we show Israeli flags all over the stadium. We stand up very loudly and proudly in support of Israel and the Jewish community during those days.
And look, I wanna push back a little bit on that, because there are a lot of people that might want to be speaking up that agree with everything, but they might say, look, if I do this, I personally and my company will lose a lot of money. What's your reaction?
I mean, I can't say I don't understand. I have a lot of friends like that. I've talked to a lot of friends who are leaders in very large public companies, private companies, who give me that exact same answer. And I do have sensitivity to that. You know, I do. I'm not in their position. I don't know everything about their company, their life, their belief systems. I'm just saying for myself what I believe. I'd like to believe that if I owned a large corporation, even if it's public or private, I would stand up and say something. But you know, I do have sensitivity to people that have a lot of issues with it, because it would destroy their business, hurt their business. It's something I understand. I mean, it's not something it's not the way I would react or act, but, you know, it's something that, I don't even want to say condone, understand, but it's something that I accept.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy for me from the side,
right?
Because I, you know, yes, I'm putting a lot on the line, but it's mostly personal. It's mostly my job, my career, my immediate family, not so much an entire business. But the way I've been thinking about it is, you work so hard throughout your life to get money, fame, power, so you can use it, not so you can keep it. And to me, when I meet people that are afraid to speak up of what they'll lose, well, why did you want to gain it in the first place? You wanted to have that influence. Now you have that influence.
And there's validity to that. You know, there is. It's tough, because I have a lot of friends who are in this position, and we've had long conversations about it, very long conversations. And, you know, one of the arguments that resonates with me in those conversations is that, okay, I won't speak up now, but there are things I can do within my business that I am doing to support the Jewish community, to support Israel, to continue to give incredibly philanthropically to different organizations. So, you know, there are roles for everybody, I feel like. Yeah. And that's an argument that kind of like, I'm like, okay, I understand where you're coming from at least a little bit.
So, and you've been to very big, very well-known universities, Duke, Northwestern, which have had very different reactions to what's been happening. I know that you were protesting even before October 7th about what was happening at CUNY in New York. I want to ask you, not as someone who is Jewish, but as someone who has run businesses, who is a leader, has really been the motivating force for a huge workforce. What would you advise the leaders of these universities to do differently?
So, great question. So let's start with Duke University, where I went to undergrad. I had the I was invited with Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, to go and have a just three of us conversation with the president of Duke University. And this was in, I want to get the date right, maybe like in January, February. So about 3 months after. Yeah, after October 7th, 2024. And so we sat in like a small, in his office board table with, and he brought three or four of his leading deans to the meeting as well. And there was a lot of conversation. Jonathan presented, you know, what was taking place on campuses around the country. And I'll never forget the president of Duke saying to us, "Tell me what I can do to support the Jewish students on campus."
What's the president's name?
President Price, Vincent Price. And he got it. He was supportive from the start. Maybe I don't know if he wants me to say this in a public forum, but he was very protective of the Jewish students. There was something maybe I shouldn't say. But he was very, very protective. And that's what every college president needs to do. There was a rumor of an encampment at one point, and it was out there for about maybe 30 minutes to an hour, 10, 20 people. It was handled very well before, during, and after. They weren't there for very long. And there was no tents. There was nothing that was set up. I went to Northwestern for graduate school, to Kellogg, and it's been the exact
Kellogg
opposite.
Kellogg is the business school.
Is the business school at Northwestern. It's been the exact opposite. The president there, as we saw him testify in front of the House committee, basically gave in to the terrorists' demands, as I see it. Yeah. Gave in to the encampment, to what they wanted. And by the way, I had a reunion there 2 weeks after the agreement was even signed between the encampment people and the administration at Northwestern. And but the encampment was still there. So whatever they signed, it wasn't put into practice in terms of removing the encampment immediately and quickly.
So By the way, I think that's something that you and I would have predicted and known in advance. Like when you try to pacify people who use force, then they just feel like, oh, now I can use more force.
Right. Yeah. You know, giving into them just shows that they're going to get more. They want more. They're going to ask for more, and they're going to get more. Yeah. It's completely, and the way he answered the questions, as we all saw, you know, I felt very weak and not standing up for the community. And unfortunately, he is Jewish, and it's unfortunate to see that he couldn't stand up very strongly for his Jewish population, protecting his Jewish students who simply don't feel safe on campus. And that's the most important thing a president's role is to protect all of his students. Mm. And when one sect of his population is being threatened, as you know, as well as anybody literally in the world, the administration has the obligation to protect you and to protect the students, to make sure that they feel safe. Like the fact that we even have to say this out loud, if any other minority group felt threatened on campus, they would be protected. Do we have any doubt of that?
Immediately.
Yes. There'd be expulsions. There would be consequences for actions. There's none of that when Jewish students are protected. There's lines like, well, what about the context of what they're saying? What about, you know, they're not directly threatening an individual. They're not directly saying that this person needs to be removed from campus. It's all absurd. It's all excuses for not wanting to protect the Jewish students. And to me, that's unacceptable. And it's what I did see with the Duke president. And I'm not seeing in the other university that I was a part of.
Right. I think that's actually a very interesting point, because one of the things that a lot of people feel is like, okay, I want to do something and I don't know what, and they feel like they need to start everything in advance. But as a business leader, you know, and you go to business school, you get the case study. You don't reinvent the wheel. You learn from other people's successes and other people's failures. And all the university presidents need to do is look at the universities that have been doing well and pick up the phone, call Duke's president, call
University of Florida. Louis,
University of Florida, call Brandeis, say, hey, how have you been dealing? It looks like you've been doing better. And also call Columbia and say, like, what the fuck have you been doing? Like, right. What should I not do? Right. Right? Like, that's how we should, that would be a good advice for all of them.
Yeah, I mean, you would think that they have some sort of Zoom call once a week or something like that, where they're discussing things that go well and things that don't go well at universities. But it's incredible.
So let's talk role models, because you have a very, very specific and close role model, your grandfather. Tell us the story.
So yeah, I say this often, and I always get emotional when I say it, because my two role models in life were my grandfather and my mom. And that's my mom's father, so it's the same side of the family.
And your mom passed away in 2012?
My mom passed away 11 years ago. My grandfather passed away 5 years ago.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you.
But he lived a long life.
He lived a long, pretty incredible life, if you know anything about him. But he was a business leader, and he was a wild, amazing human and did lots of crazy things in his life. But for me, he was a man who treated me like a son and I loved like a father. And I respected more than anything in the world, because he showed our family the importance of Tikkun Olam, of giving back to the Jewish community, of standing up as a Jew, of standing up very proudly in his own wild way too, you know, and being massively philanthropic. And being very, very loving. And my mom was the same way.
But wait, let's push a little bit about your grandpa a little bit, because he also was one of the first people to desegregate his business, his restaurants in the South.
Something I'm enormously proud of. He was also a civil rights leader.
And he marched with Dr. Martin Luther King.
He was not only marched, but he was a financial supporter of his. And Martin Luther King, even on my grandfather's, one of his last birthdays, 91st birthday, Martin Luther King's son flew to Israel to present my grandfather with an award that I flew to Israel. I was there as well. And just to clear that story, he owned five and dime stores in the South called McCrory Stores. And they had these cafes in the back. And this was in the deep South. He owned these stores. And he was the first Jewish or any leader to say, those cafes in the South will not be segregated. I am desegregating those cafes. He was humiliated that it was even an issue that he had to resolve. He was proud to loudly and amazingly stand up and say, this is wrong. He corrected that wrong.
If he were with us today, what would he say and what would he do?
God, I think about that all the time. If my mom and my grandfather were here, what their reactions would be. I think they'd be, you know, overwhelmed with, you know, I don't want to say grief, because like they weren't grieving type people. They were very much happy and alive people, but they would be really upset and be really massively disappointed in so many groups that have been so silent. So many groups. My grandfather was massively philanthropic, but he wasn't only philanthropic to the Jewish community. He gave to so many different charities, Catholic charities, Black charities, NAACP, like so many charities that he was involved in. And a lot of Jews do that. We're a very giving philanthropic community. I do that. I have so many friends in other communities. And we're just seeing a lot of silence, not from everyone. And I do have friends that are supportive and have stand up. But we're seeing
from the organizations.
From organizations or from minority communities that we've supported. But in a large sense, we're seeing a lot of silence. And I think the disappointment, I can see almost my grandfather's face as I close my eyes and I see him. Like, I see how disappointed he would be, and I see how shocked my mom would be in the silence that's taking place when the violence and when the aggressiveness against our community is so real and so clear that the silence would be disappointing, not to mention the outright anti-Jewish stuff that's taking place. You know, but the silence, I think, would be most disappointing to them.
What about your mother?
My mother was, I mean, she was one of the most amazing people. And I know I'm her son, but I say it objectively. She was a noted psychologist on the Upper East Side and an amazing philanthropist. And my sister and I used to joke that we thought our living room was a Jewish catering hall because she would host every Jewish organization. She focused more on the Jewish organizations. Every Jewish organization came to our house for a dinner, which I've tried to keep on going in my life. I used to live downtown. I had a big terrace, and I hosted all sorts of Jewish organizations, and that's because my mom's spirit was in me, to say, like, Ari, this is our obligation to the world. This is what we do.
Her name was Mona.
Mona, right? Dr. Mona.
And she had a sort of Dear Mona advice,
yeah, very good, yeah,
op-ed kind of thing. What advice would she give? Like, I assume, imagine right now, people would be writing in asking, like, how do I deal with all this hate that we're experiencing? How do I fight back? How do I make the world better for Jews and non-Jews? Like, what do you think? What advice would she give?
I'm not my mom, like, in terms of, like, her level of intellect and her amazingness in terms of reading people and understanding situations, which is why I've asked her best friends. I'm still very close to her two best friends, one in particular, Miriam, and I've asked her, what would mom be saying right now? Like, I asked my sister, what do you think mom would be saying right now? And we can't even come up with an answer because it's almost unanswerable right now. Like, what is taking place? And that's at least our answer. Maybe my mom, I know my mom would have a better answer than that. But it's just like, stay the course, stay strong, be proud of who you are, stand up for what you believe in, you know, all the stuff that we talked about, I think would definitely be a message that she would resonate with and that she would convey to other people. And continue to reach out, continue to, you know that you're on the right side of history and you're doing, you know, the right thing, and the Jews have survived amazingly much worse than this. I don't know. You know, and that we will survive as a people, and as long as you stand up and you fight and you stay strong, you know, that's what's going to take place. Like, look at Queen Esther, and look at, you know, Moses, mm-hmm. and look at all the heroes we have in our past, and Shifra and Pua, you know, like, I love bringing them up, you know, they saved the babies from Pharaoh, who wanted to kill the firstborns, and Shifra and Pua were the midwives who saved all the Jewish babies. In the Passover story. You know, so there's so many heroes over generations and generations of our people that...
And there's something about a people, like, and, you know, as someone who very, very much treasures the Torah, but also does not believe it's a word of God, it's a word of men and women. There's something still about a people who choose to tell these stories. We choose to tell these stories about, like, the story of Esther, the story of Hanukkah, the story, right. Like, we choose to tell these stories of, like, the people that stood up and fought back, and everyone says our history is all about, like, anti-Semitism after anti-Semitism. Like, right. No, our history is all about fighting against anti-Semitism again and again and again.
And winning.
We're still
each
around.
Time we come out victorious, because if we don't, we wouldn't be around as a people, you know, and that's the same thing that Israel is facing right now. Literally a fight for its survival. You have Hamas, you have Hezbollah, Iran, all the people around them who literally want them annihilated from this world. And yet Israel continues to fight back so bravely and so strongly and so humanely. It's the next iteration of the heroes of our people, as I see it.
Right. It's something that I really hope when people hear us speaking, take this not as it's so depressing, like, right. the fight's going to keep going on forever. It's like, well, I don't know if it's going to keep going on forever, but we are fighting back. That focus on the fighting back.
Agreed. Right? I do a lot of social media posting on my Instagram and stuff like that, and I get a lot of hate, I know you do too, but I also get a lot of support.
Amazing
support. And the word that I love hearing most is, like, thank you for inspiring me. I don't know if that's because it's like, wow, I'm inspiring someone to, like, be proud of their Judaism, but also they're inspired. They're going to do more now. They're going to be more outspoken. They're going to do something for the betterment of our people. And that to me is the best compliment I can
give. Right. It's to me, the way I think about it is, like, we're tossing pebbles into a lake and you got small ripples and you never know what the ripple's going to happen.
Right.
And we just got to keep tossing pebbles, because one of those ripples is going to turn into a wave and going to change everything.
Amen. And you know, everybody's got a platform, no matter how big or small. And it's important that everybody uses that platform.
So what do you think does the future hold in store for the Jews and for Israel?
I mean, Israel will survive, no doubt about it. I think they're in for a really tough situation, if we're talking geopolitically, with Hezbollah in the north. I think there's going to be a really tough, bloody, nasty situation there, especially if Iran comes in hard behind them or simultaneously. They already backed them, obviously, financially and in other ways, but if they come in from that front as well, it's going to be very, very complicated. But, you know, they can't lose. I mean, there's no option to lose. And they know that. We know that. American Jews are behind them. European Jews are behind them, although they have their own tough battle in their countries as well, as we all do. But the Jewish community is united. You know, it's one thing, you know, that October 7th did that I don't think people were expecting, is that in some way the Jewish community realized that we need to support each other more so than they ever have in the past and support Israel. Every polling I've ever seen from Jews shows their continued support for Israel. And those polls and those, you know, words from people who weren't necessarily so pro-Israel in the past are very encouraging and a good sign for the future of Israel. And, you know, the tough battle that's looming, unfortunately.
But, you know, I look at those polls and I'm like you. I see, you know, 85, 90%, 95% are Zionists or among the Jews and agree with Israel. And, you know, while they might not agree with every policy the government is doing and not everything, the IDF, as they should, you know, it's a democracy. You can't agree with everything. But they, in general, agree. And yet, like, most of the media, most of even the Jewish world, they focus on the 20%, 15%, 10% that say, no, I don't agree, or it's not important to me. Like, why that focus? Why are we so focused on those very tiny minority of Jews that are excluding themselves from the community?
I don't know if we focus on it as much as the media loves to talk about that, you know, because that's a story. That, you know, there's whatever the Jewish Voices for Peace or whatever the movement's on, or the Natiri Karta, whatever, you know, those ultra-Orthodox who, you know, are against Israel. Like, that's news. That's stuff that is easy to report on. It's easy to make a big headline about. And it's unfortunate because it's the really small minority of the Jewish community that feels that way. And, you know, most of the Jewish community, most of my friends who I talk to, people that, you know, are normal Jews, they might not like Netanyahu, they might not like the government as you described, but they are staunch supporters of Israel and always will be. And those are the people that we have to remember that are the majority and, unfortunately, the silent majority. And not the second, because there are loud people in that camp as well. But we hear too much. We hear an out-percentaged amount from the minority community of the Jews that are against Israel, which is, to me, it pains my soul when that happens.
To hear those. It is very hard to, you know, to deal with that. When you and I and most of us or all of us know that those are the exception to the rule, right, and then them getting so much focus and detracting from our fight for Jewish civil rights.
Right.
But you did say something that I want to examine a bit more. You said,
here comes trouble.
No. again, just for people who are listening, both of us are wearing all black, so I feel okay asking about this. You said Israel can't lose, and I think you meant it's not that it can't feasibly lose, it's that that's not an option on the table. And I think that's also true for the Jewish diaspora. What happens if it does?
I don't even think I can answer that question, because, you know, then our survival as a people is at stake or in danger, and that's not an option.
But let me play devil's advocate or Sinwar's advocate. A lot of people say, no, I'm not. I have nothing, no problem against the Jews. It's just the Zionism, the Zionist entity, you know, Israel. We get rid of Israel and you guys will be fine.
My opinion on if that's a possibility, again, it's not a possibility. The, you know, as we talked about, we've been fighting this fight since Abraham. I mean, this is a fight that the Jews will always take on. I mean, anti-Semitism is, I hate to break it to people, is never going to go away. You know, anti-Zionism, which to me is anti-Semitism, is never going to go away. And so we just have to understand that. Israel does understand that. And they know that, you know, to a large part, especially in Congress and, you know, on in other areas, the Americans do support Israel. You know, even in polling, Americans do support Israel still. And that's not going away, you know, in our lifetime. And so Israel does have supporters. It does have backing that to make sure of its survival, because there is no other option. I it's hard for me to answer that question because I don't even see that as an option.
But why are we even, you know, I born and raised in Israel, right? So yeah. I'm Israeli. You visited Israel a lot, and I think you visited Israel right after October 7, right? You haven't.
Yeah.
Oh, for some reason I thought. But Israel looms very large in your psyche. Why are we even talking about Israel? Like, I'm doing a civil rights podcast about Jewish civil rights.
Right.
Can't we do without Israel?
Definitely not. When we enter the Seder every year, we say next year in Jerusalem. Israel is so much a part of being Jewish as our historical homeland, as the people that we are, that you can't, this is my opinion, you cannot separate Israel from Judaism or Jews. It's just not in the cards. And, you know, we all, as we said, not everybody, we all feel that. A lot of us feel that to our core. And, you know, my mother was born in Israel, so my grandfather grew up in Israel, so I have a personal, very strong personal connection to it. But even people that don't always, you know, understand the importance that Israel plays if you are a Jew.
Mm. You know, it's as an Israeli, it gives me so much strength and hope to hear American Jews speak like that. Because for many, many years, I felt that American Jews obviously accept me, welcome me as an Israeli, you know, always been warm and open their homes for me. But there's always been a little bit of a distance. You know, you're Israeli, that means you're a little bit more rough around the edges, that means you're a little bit more militant. Me personally not, obviously, but as anyone who's met me for more than 5 minutes. But then all of a sudden, you know, when people say like October 7th made Israelis more Jewish and the Jews more Israeli, and to
like
see that.
That
connection, and I do feel that connection, it's just, it really gives me a lot of hope.
I'm glad to hear that. I mean, because we always have your back. We always will, you know, and Judaism and Israel are completely intertwined as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So you're obviously very informed about a lot of things. People who want to learn more about Israel, about the Jewish diaspora, about Jewish life, Jewish heritage, you have any books, movies, recommendations?
It's all the usual ones, like Noah Tishby's book, you know, Most Misunderstood Country in the World. I think is a must read, and Startup Nation.
Dan Senior.
Yeah, Dan Senior, exactly. Mm-hmm. To me, like what always inspired me was the book Exodus. You know, not only because the lead character is Ari Ben Kanan, who, you know, Ari, but it's like the story of like the founding of the State of Israel and coming, you know, they came to Israel post-World War II and established a state out of nothing, and like that old Israeli hero sort of character, which kind of reminds me of my grandfather, actually. Maybe is why I connected to it so much. But as an inspiration, I just always love the book Exodus. I always recommend it to people who want to just sort of see, like, you know, the old school Israel.
Yeah.
Those are, I think, are great.
Those are great. I don't know if you did this on purpose, but you basically said, okay, so Exodus, Noah Tishby's book about understanding Israel, and then Startup Nation. It's like past, present, and future.
Ooh, I didn't, but I like that.
Right?
I like
it's about where we came from, who we are, and what we can achieve.
Exactly.
I really love that.
And Senior's book is probably, what is like, probably 15 years old, 10 years old already. It could even be updated or even more incredible.
Yes. And he also has a new book that came out very, yeah. you know, scheduled, you know, this was very serendipitous about Israeli resilience.
Right, right.
It came out. So what I like to do is end with a, what I call a Jewish lightning round.
I love that.
So, you know, answer with whatever questions, whatever answers immediately come to mind. There's no right or wrong answer. You get one pass, so you can get a pass.
How many questions are there? So I know how to use my pass.
There are 10 questions. 10, I believe, yes. All right, so, Ari, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I went skydiving. I don't know if that's like the best thing. People don't know about me. I think I said earlier that I actually went to have a yeshiva background, that I went to Jewish day school because I don't, I'm more of a cultural Jew right now.
Mm-hmm. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Don't know about the Jews? That we're better athletes than people give us credit for.
Really?
Oh, well, yeah.
Who's your favorite Jewish
well,
athlete?
I know every single Jew that is an athlete, especially a professional athlete. Uh-huh. In fact, so there's something called the World Baseball Classic, where it's countries playing against each other. I don't know if you know this. Yeah. And Team Israel had a great team. They made the round of eight, and we hosted them in Miami at Lone Depot Park, in Marlins Park. And so I sat next to the guys. They're
wait,
all
wait,
friends
of mine. But to be fair, yeah. Team Israel, how many of them are American Jews?
They're mostly American Jews.
Okay.
But that's great. Like yes. they had to officially become Israeli citizens to be part of the team. So they made Aliyah. And these were like really good ball players who made the rounds. They even beat Nicaragua in a game that I was at and with a bunch of friends of mine sitting there, sitting next to the dugout. And it was just great. So we're better athletes than people give us credit for. And by the way, yeah, go ahead. I'm maybe asking another question.
I love it. I love this. I have to make a confession. I've never been to a baseball game in
my
life.
Oh, my God, Shai, you're coming with me.
And I will... I want to be next time Team Israel's playing.
Team Israel, they had four games in our stadium, and I went obviously to all four, and I had different groups every time. All friends, people you know, were with me. It was great. It was great.
I love it.
And the team, 2 years from now, we host them again. So maybe you'll come for
okay,
that.
Okay, I'm waiting for the invite. All right. So, what is your favorite curse?
Curse? I don't really curse a lot, but.
Like you stub your toe middle of the night.
I'll pass because I'm really not a cursor. Yeah.
When was the last time you cried?
I cry. I'm a very sentimental guy. So my daughter for Father's Day gave me a bracelet. I'm going to cry right now. She gave me a bracelet that she made herself and that makes me cry. I mean, because we didn't talk about my children, but everything I do right now is because of them. Because I want to make sure, we did talk about the beginning, but I want to make sure that they see that I'm standing up as a proud Jew and that it's a legacy that I'm giving to them to know that this is a massively important part of who they are as a human being, that they are a Jew and they should stand up and be proud of that for their entire lives.
Wow. I mean, if you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
So obviously my mom and my grandfather. Yeah. But, you know, if I have other guests that are invited, maybe Moses or, you know, like, wait, what happened? Tell us about the parting of the sea. Like, what was that like? Did you walk through there? Or how about Noah? Like, you really took all those animals on an ark? Like, how was the operation on that? Like, that must have been really complicated.
Spoken like a true businessman. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Good questions. So probably Passover. I love Seders. I have this tradition where my family knows that I write Passover parody songs that I'm very proud of. That's a hidden skill of mine, and actually I'm a good parody songwriter. And my daughter and I did one together the other day, last Passover, to her favorite Moana song. And so for me, like, hosting Seders and doing a tradition that has been passed on from generation to generation, the most popular, I believe, tradition in our culture, most popular celebrated holiday amongst Jews, to me, like Seders are like when everybody's gathered around and it's family and it's close friends and we're hosting. And I also do this thing when I'm hosting that we do a parody song, but I also give everybody a role at Seder. So if somebody is an environmentalist, they're the Karpas, and they have to explain the Karpas, and that's their role at the Seder. And
I'm coming next year.
Please, please come, Shai.
When? What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Least favorite? Yom Kippur, when you have to starve all day, and okay, you have to think what a horrible person you've been all year, and you're repenting for your sins because you're so bad. Like, you need a full 25 hours, not even 24, the Jews suffer an extra hour, 25 hours of no eating, no drinking, and I keep it. It's the only day every year where I'm this pious Jew, and I keep it, and there's no phone, there's no anything from you that day.
Wow. When do you feel safest?
When do I feel safest? I mean, I think just the basic answer here, when I'm home with my family, you know, just on a Friday night, we do Shabbat in our own way every Friday, not very religiously, but we do Shabbat and we do the candles and we my daughter does the motzi, and I've never missed a Friday ever where I haven't given them their prayer that the father gives to the children. And I do it individually, and even when I'm away, I zoom it in. I know I'm not supposed to zoom on Shabbat, but that's the kind of Jew I am. And I zoom it in, and that's to me when the family's together on Shabbat, just doing it the way we do it is when I feel the happiest and safest.
When do you feel least safe?
You know, when I know what I'm going to say, and I hesitated saying it, but I'll say it. No, maybe I won't. but there's a lot of hate out there,
yeah,
and I know you experience it as well, and I had certain incidences that I've experienced that have been very unsafe, and it's a scary state of the world that this is what somebody who just speaks the truth has to feel.
Yeah. What gives you hope?
What gives me hope is seeing things like this, like just talking about being Jewish, talking about being the pride in being Jewish. But also, like, the next generation, just watching these college kids, despite all they have to go through, stand up for what they believe in. Like, when I was in college, I would have never done that. Like, we discussed this at the beginning. I was social chairman of my fraternity. I was having a good time. I wasn't even a Jewish fraternity. I was doing my thing. And these college kids, first of all, they started with COVID, and now they have to fight for their survival on campus. They can't even walk around freely on campus. You know, so these are people that inspire me.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
I mean, because we're so in it right now, I mean, I was down at the Nova exhibition, and wow, if anybody hasn't been there, this is last week in New York, but it's going to Los Angeles and then probably Miami afterwards. I mean, they do an amazing thing in terms of showing the world the atrocities that took place on October 7th that should never be forgotten, even though we're 7-8 months out and people already are denying that this took place, when they filmed it themselves, by the way. And the way they show the exhibition and the importance of understanding the hate that's taking place in the world, not just Hamas, but in so many areas against Jews, I think the Nova exhibition is a really important place to donate right now.
Nice. Where can people find you?
So thank you for this interview. Beautiful questions. Thank you for all you're doing. Let me say that, Shai.
This is not about me. This is
not about
my guests.
And I didn't even know I was gonna say it, but like, what you've done is heroic. Thank to you. Stand up and be so loud and be so proud on a campus where it's one against 1,500 or whatever you're facing, you know, one against 10,000. The numbers are insane. And you've done such a beautiful job, you know, remaining strong. And so thank you for all you're doing.
Thanks, man.
And so, you know, me, I'm on Instagram mostly. My Instagram is A-R-I-A-C-K-E-R, Ari Acker. And I try to do things that are important for the community that I want people to see. I am a voice that you've seen my stuff. And, you know, who I try to find things that people haven't seen so much and bring notice to them, because there's so much stuff out there that needs to be corrected and needs to be shown a bigger audience too. So thank you very much, my friend.
So the name Ari or Ari means lion. You have a full head of lion's mane hair, and you have a lion mentality in your fight and in your leadership. So I want to thank you so much for being with me. And here I am with Ari Akerman.
Thank you so much for the show. It was great.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."